Well, you know, when you get as old as I am, you can be someplace for a long time. So yes, I have been at Lincoln for quite a long time. I'm not going to tell you how long. I also have the privilege of working with a new program called Room for Doubt. And here you are at the end of a six-week series that's a part of this Room for Doubt project. By the way, you'll see on the screen just now, I've got a web page up there. I'm going to post some resources for you sometime this week. worldvieweyes.org/godsfort.html. I'll have the slides that I'm using in the sermon this morning and be able to access some other resource materials there as well. But you are coming to the end of this six-week series, and wow, have you talked about some tough things. Is it okay to have doubt? For some of you, that might have fundamentally altered some things about how you think about your faith. Questions about God, questions about the Bible, questions about Jesus as God's Son. Our prayer time this morning reminded us just another instance of tragedy and suffering. Is it intolerant to say that Jesus is the way? Boy, those are tough questions. And a part of my hope and prayer is that at the end of this six-week series, it's not done with. It's only the beginning. I trust that a part of what this series has challenged you to do is to begin a new path, a new course, so to speak. But it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a challenge because we live in a culture of skepticism. You don't have to look too far. Now, I don't know how many times you read such books, but skeptics like this visible and notable example, Richard Dawkins, arguably the most well-known atheistic evolutionary biologist in the world. Dawkins doesn't really care much for folks like you and me. For example, he says when one person suffers from a delusion, it's called insanity. When many people suffer from a delusion, it's called religion. Or the skeptic examples of somebody like Christopher Hitchens. One of his books was entitled, How Religion, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Now, those are influential people in our culture, but actually perhaps one of the most permeating significant influences is not necessarily through their books. In fact, a study done by Larry Taunton talked to people who had wandered away from their faith and asked them to identify the key factors for what prompted them to be led away. And he said, I expected them to refer to people like Richard Dawkins and Chris Hitchens and others like them, but they never heard their names one time. What they did hear were references to YouTube videos or other online website forums. You see, it's very easy to have access to alternative ideas. There is a great deal of religious cynicism in our world. Did you know that the fastest growing demographic group in America today is a group referred to as the nuns? Now, don't think about folks that dress in a particular religious attire when I'm referring to the nuns. The nuns refer to those who are not affiliated with any religious group whatsoever. They're not Lutheran, they're not Presbyterian or Catholic, Christian church, they're not nothing, if I might use bad grammar. As long as I know what's right, I guess I can use it wrongly. Notice how fast this group of religiously unaffiliated has grown. The chart that you see on screen now, that group stood at about 8% in 1990, and it has grown cumulatively until it stands at almost 1/4 of Americans are unaffiliated. Folks, the good news is there's a lot of ground out there you can be tilling for Jesus. If we can make a difference. Now, younger folks, the disturbing cynicism is even more. The so-called younger group, often referred to as the millennial generation, has also grown considerably in this area of religiously unaffiliated, growing from about 11% in 1990, 22%, it doubled from 1990 to 2007. And the more recent comprehensive surveys on that put the millennials who are not religiously affiliated in any way, shape, or form at between 34 and 36%. More than 1/3. It's also specifically affected church life. The statistics on the number of young people who are raised in churches like this one, who have done Sunday school and perhaps summer Christian camps and short-term mission trips, and you add a whole bunch to it, many of them are literally wandering away from their involvement in church in their 20s, and like never before, they are not returning. Notice the stats on this and some of the concerns that are registered. Young people raised in a Christian environment, 38% of them report having significant doubt as they were growing up. 32% report having felt at one point like completely rejecting their parents' faith. And 36% of them said that they just felt like they couldn't ask their most pressing questions in church. See, part of the problem is that the church environment does not provide openness for people to ask the tough questions and even to express the doubts. That's the primary reason why we've titled this program Room for Doubt. In a book called You Lost Me, the head of the Barna Research Institute summarizes it this way, that about 60% of church young people are no longer active in church life in their 20s. And I've seen studies well into the 70% and higher. This is the lowest figure I'm even able to come up with. And when asked to identify one of the most significant factors as to why they wandered away, this is the results given to us in a study by Drew Dyke. He says, we asked them what prompted them to wander away, and they said, we shared our burgeoning doubts with a Christian friend or family member only to receive trite and unhelpful answers. Now, are you capturing two facets here? Number one, in many churches, you're not allowed to ask the questions. And then if you do, you're not given much more than trite and unhelpful answers. And we hope that this Room for Doubt project has reinvigorated you as a congregation and you as a family, you perhaps as an individual, to ask the tough questions and pursue the answers. The fundamental question is this: how can we have stable conviction in a culture of such skepticism and cynicism? And so what I want to do at the tail end of this six-week series that you've been going through is just raise some considerations for you. What can we do now? What can I do as an individual? What can we do as a family together? What can we do as a church together to help us take the next steps beyond this six-week series? So let me mention a number of considerations. I'm not going to have much time to spend on each one of them, but one of the main concerns and objectives is to create a better mood. Now, we know what bad moods are. We need to create a better mood in the Christian community. And one way that we can do that is to highlight the real motive for wanting to be and being a Christian and living a Christian way of life. Now, it's one thing to focus on the what of faith, but it's something else to communicate the why of faith. This is where that fancy word that Mike used a minute ago comes from. The word apologetics appears in a number of places in the New Testament, but in 1 Peter chapter 3, Peter says that we are always to be prepared to give an answer. And the Greek word translated as give an answer is a word, literally it's pronounced apologia, from which we get the English word apologetics. It means to give a reasoned defense for our faith. I believe that our churches, unfortunately, are filled with people who know something about the what of faith, but they have little clue about why they believe it. And if you don't truly understand why you believe it, you're not going to be capable of communicating to somebody else who asks the questions. The challenge then is for us to highlight the why. Also to stress the real objective of our faith. Now, it's one thing to believe that. I mean, Matthew 16, that's a great confession, isn't it? Jesus says, who do you say that I am? And his disciples said, well, they say you're different things. Who do you say I am, Peter? And Peter responds and says, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And whenever somebody comes to confess Christ, that is the great confession that we're privileged to express. I believe that Jesus is the Christ and the Son of the living God. It is such a wonderful confession to make. But you know what? According to James chapter 2, even the demons believe that. So it can't be enough just to believe that something. We must also have genuine trust in. Now that is where the demons fall away. But even more than having trust in, we also, most importantly, must be led to love for God. That's the real objective here. It's not just a matter of trying to convince you in some historical fact of Jesus' identity. It's a matter of leading you to see that God is worth your love. I find it especially interesting to contrast the question that Jesus asked Peter in Matthew 16. Who do you say that I am? It's a question of identity. But after the crucifixion and after the resurrection, now in John chapter 20, now Jesus' question of Peter is not, who am I? It's, do you love me? Part of my challenge for you today, regardless of who you are, whether you are inside the household of belief or outside, the question is not just, who do you believe Jesus is so that you might believe that? But the question is, how much do we love him? That is the real objective. Another point here in terms of creating a better mood, and that is, show that you are sensitive. Now, I don't mean to the sun. You're supposed to laugh at that. You know, you get sunburned easily. Do I have to spell this out? What do you have? I have to provide four steps to my jokes. It's like I tell my students. They don't get any better than this, so you better laugh at that one. It's not just enough to talk about that, what we should believe, or even why. Question is, how do you communicate your convictions to others? When we look at 1 Peter 3 and 2 Timothy 2 and Jude 22, here are the guidelines, the instructions for us. With gentleness and reverence. Oh yeah, always be ready to give an answer. And I know a lot of people who are always ready to give an answer because they got the truth.
And they'd be shoving it down your throat, whether you want it or not.
2 Timothy says, we are not to be quarrelsome, but kind. And Jude puts it this way, have mercy on some who are doubting. You see, you can have truth, and you can be a snot about it. You can have truth and do truth more harm than you might if you didn't even have it, because of the way you're trying to shove it down people's throats. And so we must strike this very difficult balance of having conviction of the truth, but at the same time being gentle with those who doubt and patient with them. You better be thankful God was patient with you. In Mark chapter 9, there was a father who came to Jesus with a very sick son. And he said, I believe, but help my unbelief. You see, it's not just a matter of you do, you don't. It's that there are a number of matters that are complex, and there are elements of our Christian faith commitment, but there are other dimensions of how we think about things, and we need God's strength and renewed and reinvigorated conviction. Here's another major suggestion for you, and that is to employ a better method in this church. Now, not that I know a whole lot of bad things about you. Mike and I and his lovely wife, we talked about fun things last night, for the most part. He wasn't ratting on you. I just know you're a church of humans who are fallen and sinful and despicable. And therefore, we all need improvement. So one thing that we can do is to be appreciative of the tough questions and even doubts. Have you heard about Dan Brown, the author of, The Da Vinci Code? Raised some fundamental questions, skepticism about the very origin of the Christian faith. You realize that Dan Brown was raised in an environment, his mother was a believer, his father was not, and he was brought up in church, and he got into his teenage years and he went to a church leader and he started to ask fundamental questions about the faith. And I've heard him give this in a video presentation. He said that this church leader kind of pointed his finger at me and he said, nice boys don't ask those questions. I can understand why Dan Brown thought the church doesn't have the answers, there's no point in hanging around. We need to be appreciative of tough questions and even of doubt. We also need to be... we need to have those tough questions. You remember John the Baptist, by the way? John the Baptist, earlier in the gospel, he's the one who's pointing to Jesus and says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And then, all of a sudden, things change. Now John's in prison. And the same man who said with all confidence, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Now he's in prison, and he sends a team of communicators, some representatives, to ask Jesus a question. And the question is this, are you the one? Or should we look for somebody else? You see, I'm so thankful that the Spirit in His providence allowed these events, these episodes, to be present in Scripture so that we would be able to identify. I know what it's like. Perhaps you know what it's like to be so confident at one time, but your life circumstances change and now you just wonder. But listen, it was even after that latter event that Jesus pointed to John. He says, nobody has been born greater than he. He didn't condemn him. What he did do was to give him some answers. You go tell John, the blind are now seeing, the lame are now walking. You see, even when you find yourself in circumstance, God is there to give some better answer. Be interrogative is the way I put it. Here's one of the amazing things. You realize that if you read through the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and counted the questions that Jesus asks, Jesus asked 173 questions in the Gospels. And here's my question. Why is somebody who's got all the answers asking all the questions for? I believe he's teaching us something critically important pedagogically. And that is, even when you know the answer, often the best thing for you to do is ask the questions. It's much more important, in my view, to know the good questions to ask of others than it is to feel bad about not knowing the answers and then not communicating because you're afraid of that. Be interrogative, also be comparative. Question is not simply how can we prove Christianity. The question is, how do the alternatives measure up? And that's what I want to run through in the last section here, to point out some comparisons and contrasts between a Christian understanding of life. And my appeal to you is that as you go forward from this time forth, from this six-week series, that you focus on the necessary matters and not get embroiled in all of important questions, for sure. But when it comes to communicating to those who do not believe or accept God or love God, we must focus on the necessary matters. Here's one necessary matter, the matter of matter. Where did it come from? That's a pretty big one, by the way. How do you explain it all? Now, there are alternatives. One of the great minds of our time is this man, Stephen Hawking, professor of mathematics at Cambridge University. He was kind of the star in this movie released a few years ago called A Theory of Everything. Here is his alternative. Because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. You don't like the God creation alternative? Well, this is the alternative. A primary alternative here. It just happened out of nothing. What do you mean it happened out of nothing? Happened out of nothing. Here's a strong advocate for this atheistic perspective. A philosophy professor at Duke University, Alex Rosenberg, he puts it this way. He says, why is there a universe at all? No reason at all. Why is there a multiverse? You got multiple verses out there, not just a universe. In which universes pop into existence for no reason at all. No reason at all. And if you want more, then just get over it. That's what the rest of that quotation says. So when we compare the alternatives, is it a challenge? Yes, to demonstrate the creation of God, but it can be done. But this is the primary alternative. Here's another big one, and that is focus on the matter of living matter. Where did life itself come from? And it's one thing to talk about Darwinism, and evolution is an important matter, and I deal with that in a number of my classes. But listen, Darwin is totally irrelevant until there is life in existence. You don't get natural selection on non-living things. So you've got to account for the very existence of life itself. And the fact is, there is a multitude of physical constants and variables in our universe that make life itself possible. If you want your mind blown for a second, just take a look at some of them. Now, most of them won't mean that much to you. But just keep in mind, it's not just believing scientists. It's those who do not believe in a God who are nonetheless amazed at the level of precision that is built into the very physical fabric of the universe that makes life possible. Fred Hoyle, an atheistic, kind of agnostic type, puts it this way. He says a common sense interpretation of the fact suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics. Even somebody who does not believe in God says, hey, something really strange is going on here. In fact, Fred Hoyle and a colleague of his calculated the mere chance of life originating on planet Earth. What are the chances that he gave? Now keep in mind, he's atheistic, agnostic, does not believe in God doing this. The probabilities that he calculated of life beginning on this planet is 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power. And there are reasons why I didn't put that up in longhand type stuff, you know. It'd be 10 with 40,000 zeros behind it. This is an amazing number when you keep in mind that the total number of elementary particles, atoms in the entire visible universe, is 10 to the 80th power. Wow, that'll blow your mind. That's why Fred Hoyle and some others like him don't believe that life originated here on this planet. It had to be transported here from someplace else in space. They call it the panspermia hypothesis. So there's kind of life sperm running around here, and it's exported from someplace else. But even you could have a bad intellectual day and know that doesn't solve the problem. The problem is, how did life originate anywhere? Francis Crick, who sometimes I say is up the Crick. In 1953, he was a co-discoverer of the structure of the DNA molecule, and he said at the time, ladies and gentlemen, we have discovered the secret of life. But not that many years later, when more was found out about the nature and the complexity of that structure, he says, an honest man armed with all the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense, the origin of life is almost a miracle. In fact, he goes on and says, every time I write a book on the origin of life, I swear I'm not going to write another one because there's too much speculation and too few facts. They don't know how life began. They're still struggling to make sense out of it. We also must focus on the matter of meaning. Now, it's possible for us to create meaning. I have 7 grandkids. Wow, they're amazing. I got an amazing wife. I get satisfaction in the job that I am able to do, the ministry that I'm able to do. Anybody can create temporary meaning, but there's a gigantic difference between creating meaning and discovering meaning. The kind of meaning that makes sense out of it all. And when it's all said and done, from a non-godly perspective, there just isn't any meaning, period. Notice again how Alex Rosenberg puts it. He says, individual life is meaningless without a purpose and without any moral value. If you don't go the God direction, these are the alternatives. We also must focus on the matter of morality. Morality. A lot of people ask this question. Do you have to believe in God to be good? My answer to that is, no, you don't. You do not have to believe in God to be good. In fact, I know of a lot of atheists who are very generous, very loving. They love their kids and grandkids. They make good cookies. They mow their lawns regularly. And they often make good friends. The question is not, do you have to believe in God to be good? The fundamental question is this: if you don't believe in God, why should you be good? Without God, I would contend there is no moral obligation whatsoever. The Russian novelist Dostoevsky puts it this way: without God in the future, everything is permitted. Here's another consideration. It's the matter of mortality. 2012, it wasn't a grand year for my family. We had 4 family deaths that year. January 1st, my beloved father-in-law, who lived with us, died of cancer. In April, my mom died pretty much unexpectedly. In May, one of my sons-in-law's brother in his 50s died of cancer. In July that year, we had a 16-year-old great-niece who was killed instantly in a car accident. What allows us to sing before an open casket, sing the wondrous love of Jesus, sing his mercy and his grace? What makes that possible? You see, our mortality, the inevitability, the necessity of our death forces us to face our finiteness. And death itself can serve as a signal to point us toward God. In the midst of tragedy and suffering, what I saw was hope. I know what it's like to be at a funeral of somebody who has no hope, and of others whose eternity looks bright in spite of the tears. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 4, we don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, about those who are dead, so that you will not grieve like those who have no hope. You don't go the God way. You don't go the Christian way. There is no hope. The last consideration I want to mention to you is the matter of the Messiah. Oh, it's an important question, all right, the identity of Jesus. But the most important question for you is this: what are you going to do with the Messiah, the special anointed one of God, who was promised long ago to come and to save us from our hopeless condition? Now, when you look at the array of considerations that I've given you today, are there tough questions? Yeah. Is there room for doubt on difficult issues? There sure are. There is. And there should be, because we are finite people who cannot comprehend the infiniteness of God. And yet, if you are one of those people who have committed yourself to Christ, if you're one of those who have decided already to follow the path of Christ, there are so many reasons why you should be bolstered in your faith. And you young people who are here, I just want to say, I'm not a prophet in any, you know, special, unique Elijah sense necessarily, other than to communicate what I believe is true for you. Your faith will become increasingly challenged as you grow older. And I hope maybe you will remember this very day, you will remember this image on the wall, and you will recall, by the influence of the Holy Spirit, there are a lot of reasons why you should remain steadfast in the way you were raised. And if you have not yet decided to believe that Jesus is the Christ and to trust in him and to have love for him, there are so many considerations that are drawing you to the love of God, especially when you compare the alternatives. Thank you for your wonderful attention this morning. May God bless you every step of your Christian way. And if you're seeking for God, may God guide every step to be closer to Him.